com in triplicate in order to be permitted. That's where the that's where we walk leave that Gemara. So what that means, and I mentioned this last time, much to the chagrin of Marshall. Oh, and one other very important point. This is true even for Ashkenazim. If you already had a pot, let's say a fleshik pot, but the pot hasn't been used for 24 hours, and you, let's say you cooked rice in it, to keep it simple, you cooked rice in it for your fleshik meal, and then you have leftover rice during the week, and you want to take that rice and pour cheese sauce over it, so that's permitted. Even for Ashkenazim, as long as the pot, when it was cooked in, was clean and hadn't been used for 24 hours as an eino ben yomo. So that's the Ashkenazi position. For Sephardim, even if the pot had been used within 24 hours, and it would appear Sephardim hold that even for sure lechatchila, you could cook rice in a fleshik pot as long as it's clean and use it with milchiks. Even that was your intent at the outset. Marshall.
Right, just another rice question. So you have a fleshik pot that's not a ben yomo. You make rice in it. While the rice is still warm, can you put it in a dairy plastic container to store?
Yes. You could, while the rice is still, rice is still warm, you can pour cheese over it, and just don't do it in that pot.
Right, but I thought maybe that you would consider that the walls of the milk container are storing it.
But there's the assumption, let me just work with the Sephardic notion, even though, even Ashkenazim, the Rama says, let's say I cook that rice in the fleshik pot ben yomo, and I already poured cheese sauce over at my plate. Ben yomo. Even for the Rama says lechatchila, you're not allowed. Obviously, you can't cook the rice in a fleshik pot, and even if you did, you're not allowed to pour the cheese sauce over it. But let's say you already cooked the rice in that clean fleshik pot, even though it's a ben yomo, it's been used 3 hours before, and you put it on your, let's say, dairy plate, or you put it on your paper plate. That's just not. And I'm not saying it's a problem. Let's just avoid that question. And you already poured the cheese sauce over it. The Rama says you can eat it. Even the Rama, you can eat it. But the Chatchila, you know, once you took it out and you realize that you're not allowed to pour the cheese sauce over it. But if you did it already, you can actually eat it. So, if it's an Eino Ben Yomo, and it's Eino Ben Yomo for sure, you put it on your dairy plate, dairy container. You can pour cheese sauce over it, not in the fleshik pot, and you're fine. Okay. So. So that's the principle of not bar not. That's what it means. There is a story, I'm sure it is apocryphal, about when you hear the term not bar not, you think it might be the name of a person, like bar, the Aramaic word for son. That's Reuven ben Shimon, not bar not. Somebody apparently was in a bechina, Ijoradei bechina in YU with the Rav and probably Rav Belkin and Rav Shatskiz. That's how the story goes. It's probably apocryphal. And one of them asked about not bar not. He says, I'm absolutely certain there's no such person mentioned anywhere in Yoradei. I don't really believe that story is true. I think it's the kind of thing the guys make up in the base medrash while they're busy hawking, but nonetheless. But that's what the term not bar not is. No Saint Tom by no Saint Tom. So for Ashkenazim, in order to use it, we either require a third Tom, or it has to be that the original Tom that you're dealing with already was not a Ben Yomo. It was a pot that wasn't used for 24 hours, so then we would permit, even Ashkenazim would permit a secondary Tom. So, Tosus deals with the question, primary issue we're going to deal with, and that's the reason I reviewed Not Bar Not, deals with the question of kashering Kalim. Now, when can you kasher a kli? So our practice, the minhag the Rama cites in Hilchos Pesach, in Simin Tafnun Beis in Orchaim, is that we don't kasher kelim, any kelim that are b'nei yoman. Our minhag is to kasher any kli for any purpose, under any circumstances, we wait 24 hours after the kli has last been used. Now, what would happen if you didn't? So that's a separate question, but l'chatchila, we wait 24 hours.
As well?
Probably not. And I want, yes, Gabe?
So that's true with, like, let's say you go to a hotel and there's a microwave in your room. So let's say you know it's been used in the last 24 hours. You can't just, like, kosher the microwave.
Correct. You need to wait. You wait till, you know, what you can ascertain its last usage. If you don't know, I'm not going to make an estimate as to how you figure that out. But assuming you know when it was last used, 24 hours from the time it was last used. Okay, so here's the problem with koshering a pot that it has been used within the last 24 hours. Let's say it had real tray food cooked in it. So the general rule with a pot is that if you fill a pot with water, it will not contain in the water 60 times the volume of the walls of the pot. Now, if you were to take the actual pot itself, the material, melt it down and see how big that was, or whatever calculus you use to figure out how much the pot, the volume of the, let's say, the metal of the pot is, You're not going to, if you fill it with water, you're not going to have 60 times what is in the walls of the pot. So when you boil the water, let's say you boil the water in this pot to kosher it, or even possibly even if you put it in a slightly bigger pot, you're not necessarily or not likely going to have 60 times in the water keneged the pot. Now, but how much has the pot actually absorbed of tray food? The answer is we don't know. And because we don't know, the rule is when we don't know about how much the pot is absorbed, we pretend that the entire pot is, it is full. It is full to the brim. As if it's like an invisibly thin layer that you see of the pot, and it's hollow on the inside filled with tray food. Chazal knew, the Rishonim knew, we know that that's not actually the case, but we don't know how to calculate actually how much is absorbed. Therefore, unless we know that it could not have absorbed more than X. For example, I have a new pot, and then somebody cooks 10 kazesim of chazer in it. Now, the volume of the walls of the pot might be 50 kazesim. But nonetheless, we know that it cannot possibly have absorbed more than 10 kazesim of pork, because that's all that was cooked in it, you know. And that would be true, anything that was, if you know how much was cooked in it in the last 24 hours, that's the maximum amount of X that the pot could have absorbed. Again, did it absorb that amount? Almost certainly not. But we don't know how much. Therefore, we are stringent to say it absorbed all of that. So, if I have my treif pot and I boil water in it to kosher it, the problem is that the water is going to become treif. So, therefore, it's a problem koshering under those circumstances. And that came up really in the last previous Tosos, where the stringency of the Baal HaTruma, Rabbeinu Baruch, to say that when you count 24 hours from the last time a pot was used, let's say with treif stuff, so if someone boiled water in the interim, it restarts the clock. However that works out, it restarts the clock because the water becomes treif, because it's not enough water to nullify, to be mevatel, that which the pot spits out into the water, and therefore, and the water gets absorbed into the walls of the pot, and so on. So the clock basically ends up restarting. Okay. So with that in mind, so now let's take a look at the second Tosfos. We'll get to the relevant parts, come a few lines in. Mikan ve'elach lishteri. The Gemara says, the Gemara had suggested that since a pot only can make food prohibited, if you cook within 24 hours of the last usage of treif food, so the Gemara said, why not wait after 24 hours? You shouldn't have to kosher pots. And the Gemara said, you're right in principle, that's true, except for they made a gzeira on a pot, which is an eino ben yomo, not to cook in it, because you might come to cook in it when it still is a ben yomo. Fine. So now Tosfos says, asks a very simple question. I've told you probably 1,000 times, if I have my eino ben yomo pot, and I went ahead and I cooked in it, I'm allowed to eat the food. We don't say the food is treif. So Tosfos asks, Hilkach davar hamavusha b'kli she'eino ben yomo is mutar. Based upon the Gemara, the implication is that if you went ahead and you cooked in the pot, the treif pot, but it wasn't used for 24 hours, you can eat the food. B'yesh loses tam, ma ra'u lahatir hamachal v'les harkadera. Why is it that the Chachamim permit you to consume the food, but they prohibit you from using the pot? If it's both cases, what does the pot have in it? It has a ta'am pogum. It has a detrimental flavor of iser in it. And what does the food that you cook in that have in it? The exact same thing. So why is one prohibited, and why is one permitted? Now, the truth is, if you asked me, Tosis is going to give a very interesting answer. I'm not really bothered by the question. The answer seems fairly obvious. There's a difference between lechatchila and b'di'eved. In other words, yeah, you're not supposed to cook food in the pot, but it's not that the pot is, you're not eating the pot, right? If you liked eating pots, that were your habit for whatever reason, it'll be the new environmental thing. We'll have edible pots. So presumably, the treif was cooked in that pot, and now it's an eino ben yomo, assuming that it actually worked that way, I'm not sure it would, but hypothetically, so we would also probably say you could eat the pot at that point. In other words, it's because there's nothing you can do about the food. If you're going to tell me the food is treif, you have to throw the food out. The pot, you can fix. So I would have thought that the answer is obvious, that l'chatchila, we are stringent on nosen tam mafgam, but b'di'eved, after the fact, so we can lean on. We don't want to have to throw out the food. But Tosfos gives a different answer. Tosfos says, he thinks the reason is, l'fi shakadera hayabo iser gomer tchila, av halamachal lo nivelo bo iser me'olam. He says that the pot, originally, when you cooked in it, at that stage, there was iser absorbed in the pot. When you first cooked the treif food in it, if you use that pot to cook other food, it will make the food treif, because the flavors absorbed in the pot for the first 24 hours are considered positive. They are l'shvach. So therefore, because the tam in the pot started out in there as l'shvach, as isur, That's why the Chachamim made a decree that you're not allowed to use the pot at all. But the food that you cook in the pot after 24 hours, when the food first goes in, when the flavor first goes into the food, it's already not prohibited anymore. It's already tam pagum, and therefore it's not a problem. That's the answer that Tosfos suggests. Okay, be that as it may, now Tosfos gets to the point that we were talking about earlier. V'hagolas kli ben yomo, ein lahagil ela bishishim. If you want to kasher a pot that's been used within the last 24 hours, you need to make sure that the water in which that pot is being placed has shishim to correspond to the walls of the pot itself. Why? The shamnunis hanifla, literally the fatty stuff that is spit out into the water, bechamin tam l'shvachu. In the first 24 hours, that's no same tam l'shvach, and therefore the only way to make the hagala work is to make sure that there's bittul, that the isur, that the prohibited flavor that comes out, has bittul b'shishim. It has enough water to nullify the tam. But now Tosfos says something interesting, and this is where it's, Tosfos observes, earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara says that if a non-Jew heats hot water, you're allowed to use that. Why? Because the flavors in the pot that were put in the water are no sein tam lefgam. So what's going on? So Tosfos says that the lo shirinan le'el b'perek sheni chamin shel akum ela mishum destam kleihem ena b'nei yomon. You know why you're allowed to use the kosher water that a non-Jew heats up in his pots? Because we assume that most pots are not b'nei yomon. This is a major question. We assume, the default assumption is that any pot that you're dealing with hasn't been used in the last 24 hours. It might be true in the absence of all knowledge, it might be true statistically, probably it would be for most people, it probably would not hold true in a restaurant, right? And with certain circumstances, that does not hold true clearly, but in other circumstances, I think the Shulchan Aruch assumes that stam kelim of a guy are not considered b'nei yomon. And if you were thinking about Jews, it's a good bet to say that on Shabbos, you cannot imply the principle by most people's fleisha kelim that they're not b'nei yomon, because you know there's probably a pretty good chance they were used on Friday. But for a non-Jew, in the absence of any other knowledge, a lot of Rishonim, and I think the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, that we assume, unless we know otherwise, that Kli's not a Ben Yoma. So that's why the Tosfos says the Gemara permits hot water that was boiled in a non-Jew's pot. Why do we permit that? Because we assume the Kli was not a Ben Yoma. But if the Kli is a Ben Yoma, then you're not allowed to use the water, and therefore you can't kasher treif kalim unless you know that are Ben Yoman, unless you know there's 60 times in the water. Once you wait till after 24 hours, so then it's not a problem, because the flavor that comes out of the pot at that point is no same time of gum. It doesn't make the water us, so there's no problem of any reabsorptions, and that's not a problem. Marshall.
But then, why wouldn't the Shulchan Aruch and the Shulchan Aruch tell Gabe to use the microwave in the hotel? Kosher the microwave when he gets there, on the assumption that it wasn't used
there. So I deliberately avoided the question of how do you determine that. I would only say the following. His question is, if many Rishonim in the Shulchan Aruch rule that the assumption that stam kalim of a non-Jew, meaning a kli, you don't know what its status is. Stam. You assume it's not a ben yomo. It probably hasn't been used in the last 24 hours. So the question is, why can't Gabe kosher the microwave when he walks into this, you know, this hotel that he's staying in?
And he said he knew that it was
correct. That's the answer based upon Gabe's formulation. If you didn't know, so I would only say the following. I don't mean to be such a charedi about this, but I think you do have to, if you want to apply the principle of stam kelim ben yomo, you do have to think about it situationally. And I don't know what the answer is. Do most people in the, you know, what is the probability? What's the probability that someone, A, used the microwave before you, and B, used it for something that wasn't kosher? Of course, I'm not even discussing the adrenal question, what the status of a microwave is. That might be a different issue. But what is the probability that it was used? But I think if how you figure that out, I don't know. But if you were to do a back-of-the-page calculation and determine that the likelihood, that it was a low likelihood, a low probability that the kli was used within the last 24 hours with tray food, then the answer is, yeah, you could assume you could kosher right then.
Two questions, then I'll move on. When I get a microwave in a hotel, it's always unsurprisingly treated like a very idiosyncratic request. We're not sure, we'll let you know, whatever, right? They're nice and tough. I would say that in a vacation house, you probably could not make the assumption, because it's very likely that if somebody was there the day before and you don't know that there wasn't a day's wait, that they probably did cook it. I think if you're getting a microwave sent up to your room in a hotel,
probably.
But what if you're vacationing with your party with in-laws? who don't have to hold by Ben Yoma. And they kosher the kaven as soon as you arrive, and can you use them? Because for them, they're 100% kosher without having to wait.
No. Hold on. No, wait. You made a leap here. I said to our minhag, and I'll explain to you where the minhag comes up as Bnei Ashkenaz, is to not kasher anything within 24 hours. It doesn't mean that everything can be kasher 24 hours. And as what Tosus is talking about so far, Sfaradim would agree to also. In other words, you can't kasher a kli that you know is a ben yomo, and you don't have 60 times in the water. You probably, even Sfaradim would hold, you can't kasher that within 24 hours. The question is, what if I have a situation where I do have shishim, and I can get a big enough pot with water, or, you'll see the real common examples that comes up in a moment, we'll talk about Erev Pesach, those situations where Sfaradim would hold, that where Meikar, then you can actually kasher within 24 hours, and I'll explain in a moment, and yet the Ashkenazic minhag is just not to do it. We just wait, because we're afraid people will get confused between situations where you can kasher within 24 hours versus situations where you can't. But the situation where you really can't kasher within 24 hours is where you have something that was used with treif, and you don't know that you have shishim, you know, to be mevatel the treif, you know, a flavoring. So now Tosa says the following. Avol.
It would also be a difference nowadays versus the time of the Gemara. Nowadays people have many more pots than they had at that time, so the likelihood of them using it is much lower.
So I think that's true. That only would increase the probability. But again, if you're talking about a totally blind random sampling, yes. But I suspect that if you go into someone's kitchen, you can probably say the following. If they have 10 pots, you know that probably 8 of those pots, the odds that have been used in the last 24 hours are infinitesimal. But there are probably a couple of pots that you could say, well, there's a much, much higher probability because of the pots they use most frequently. So that's all a situation with question. In other words, I would not take the Shulchan Aruch's assumption that Stam Kalim of a Goy or not Binyom and automatically apply that in all circumstances if I have other information. And it's possible, right? I know which pots in my kitchen are used, you know, once a Yovel, and which pots are used, you know, at least once a week and more frequently than that. So if I have the ability to find out more information, so we don't rely upon Suffolk if we can ascertain more information. It may be at the end of the day we'll still be stuck, and we might rely upon the principle, assuming that it's plausible. But yes, I think that's the fundamental point is correct. We have many more pots than they had, and therefore, on any given pot as a true random sampling, it is very unlikely that it is a ben yom. So now, the real time that it matters, which is Erev Pesach, or before kashering for Pesach. So Tosso says, Avol keshemagilin klei chametz be'erev ha-pesach be'arba sha'os d'shas heter hi. When you're kashering kelim on Pesach, before the fourth hour, before chametz becomes aser, so Tosso says that yocho lahagil afilu kli ben yamo b'pachos mishishim. Tosa says that you can do, this is not our minhag, we're machmir, but al pidin, you can kash your kalim before the fourth hour on Erev Pesach. Right? After the fourth hour is over, you can't eat chametz becomes prohibited b'hana, the stuff that's absorbed in the pot, if the pot is a ben yomo of chametz, it theoretically could flavor things positively, l'shvach, and would be a problem. But before 4 hours, Tosa says, it's not a problem. Use it, kashering. Why? The have not barnat Shel Heter. There's a situation where we can rely upon not bar not. Now let me just add one detail to something. I said it this last week, I'll repeat it again. For Sfaradim for the moment, to keep it easier to see this. We say that if you cook fish in a fleshed pot, you can pour cheese over the fish. Very nice. Why? Because the flavor of the meat is not considered flavor because it's not bar not. Meat into the pot into the fish. So let me ask you a question. As I said last week, why can't you just cook milk in the pot? And say, meat into the walls of the pot into the milk, it's not bar not, the meat doesn't count. So what's the problem? Why do we need two sets of dishes? So the answer is, not bar not only works when it's what we call not bar not of heter. Otherwise, it wouldn't just be true for meat and milk, it would be true for treif pots as well. Chazer into the pot into the kosher food, okay, it's not bar not. So that's wrong. Why? So the idea of not bar not is the following. Once you have something which is already a secondary flavor, and it is permissible to consume. Now, the question is, how do we relate to that? So I have meat, which is already a secondary flavor of the meat. It's clearly a weakened tom. So if that meat, tom, were to go into milk, that's a problem. That's basar b'chalav. But let's say the meat did not go into milk. The meat went into fish. And now I ask the question, at this stage, is that flavor of meat even considered meat? And if it's not, I could now take the fish, which has that tamet, and mix it into milk. In other words, what the halacha says is that flavor of meat is so weak that basar b'chalav cannot be formed by the combination of that tam with milk. It's simply not strong enough to allow the creation of this new substance, right? Basar b'chalav is a real chemistry project, right? It's two things of heter, two things that are permitted that come together, and you have an explosion, and now you have iser here. So in order for that explosion to take place, you need to have a strong enough flavor of milk and a strong enough flavor of meat to be considered milk and meat. And a secondary flavor of meat is not considered gedi for lo sevashel gedi b'chalevimo. It's no longer considered gedi. But if it's a primary flavor, it goes into the pot, and now you put it into milk, at that stage, it's strong enough to create basar b'chalav. So the rule is, in order for nat bar nat to be permitted, however many flavor change you require, Svardim require two, Ashkenazim require three levels of flavor, it has to be heter. It has to be when you get to either stage 2 for Sephardim or stage 3 for Ashkenazim, you look at it and say, everything's good, you're allowed to consume it. It's true, I might not be able to consume, for the moment, that meat flavor with milk, but at least it's permissible consumption. Now that I've ruled that it's permissible consumption, it's not even considered meat anymore, and it cannot fuse with milk to make basar b'chalav. And if it's, and it would be true with any other situation. The chametz is the one that we are dealing with here. So Tosus says, if you bring this back to chametz before the fourth hour, you're allowed to eat. So Tosus claims, this is a very controversial point, although not in this topic, and something we're going to learn next. Tosus says that chametz is het there before the fourth hour, and nobody would debate that you can eat it before the fourth hour, but he says it's labeled as het there, it's not even called chametz. And now, if you had a chametz dikka pot, that you use within the last 24 hours, and now you boil water in it. So what is the status of the chametz that comes, it pulls the chametz out of the pot into the water? Are you allowed to drink the water?
Heter.
Yeah, it's before the fourth hour, why not? So that's already not bar not of heter, but Tosus goes a step further. Even if you're going to need three, what's the next step? The water might send the chametz, or the water might go into the pot. That's not bar not bar not. Now, is the pot still usable and kosher? Yes, it's before the fourth hour on Pesach, an Erev Pesach. And therefore, Tosfos says, I think he'll say explicitly in a moment, even if you need three no snei tam, where he said that in the last Tosfos, even if you need three, chametz before the fourth hour on Pesach, if you kosher the kli, is not bar not bar not of heter. And therefore, Tosfos says, you don't need shishim in the water to be mevatel the tam of the chametz, because any chametz that might eventually go back into the pot will be not bar not bar not, and it's mutter, and therefore it's not considered a tam of chametz anymore. It's not a problem now when Pesach comes. You might say the following, we'll see this in the Gemara a little later. Chametz, what happens at the fourth hour of Pesach? The universe, the metaphysical isser of chametz in the universe comes and falls down or places itself upon every piece of chametz that we have, certainly that a Jew has, maybe that a non-Jew has as well. Tosus says, when you have, once it's chametz, which is a not bar not, it's such a weakened flavor, that metaphysical chametz cannot come and label this, now this is chametz in Erev Pesach, you know, and the fourth hour has come. So that's why Tosus says you don't have to worry about, once, as long as you do your koshering, before the fourth hour on Erev Pesach, you don't need to have the kalim be Einam ben Eyom, and they can have been used within 24 hours. As I said, the Ramah himself is mach. He quotes a minhag because people will get confused that we don't kasher anything within 24 hours. But certainly, if someone did b'di'evid, the kashering actually works. There is a situation where this, in many cases, depending upon the model, but maybe true with, it could be true with all models, dishwashers, you know, if you run a dishwasher probably self-kashers. In most cases, the ones that at least I've explored, the last cycle of the water is going to kasher. There's nothing you can do about it. So if I, let's say, people ask me, can I use the same dishwasher for milks and fleishiks? And I answer, I'm going to tell you no, go ask your local Orthodox rabbi. But at least on a purely theoretical plane, if you have a dishwasher, as I have described, and I suspect almost all dishwashers work that way, the last cycle is the hottest water, it's clean already at that point. And if you're talking about fleishiks or milchiks, not a treif dishwasher, fleishiks or milchiks, so Hagala works on fleishing shel milchik within 24 hours. You're not supposed to do it. You're supposed to wait till after 24 hours, but it does work, and a dishwasher doesn't even give you a choice. It's just automatic, and that's how a dishwasher works. It first, it, you know, rinses the, let's say, the meat off the dishes, and then it has another cycle with the soap and so on, and by the time you get to the third cycle and everything's clean and you use water that was hotter than any water that was used before, so the dishwasher has automatically been koshered, even though you have no control over it. So that actually, technically, if someone called me up in Erev Pesach with a shaila and said, this is what happened, I would say that your dishwasher already koshered itself, so, and the koshering does work by chametz b'dieved, at least according to Tosus and the way the Shulchan Aruch paskins as well. It works even though you're not supposed to do it. In other words, the koshering does work.
Is there an issue of ben yoma with a dishwasher, or it's not relevant?
So again, if you asked me, I would tell you, because in the Rambam would say people get confused, if you have a dishwasher that you hold that you can kosher for Pesach, let's say it's a stainless steel dishwasher, I won't go into all the details, that you should wait 24 hours to kosher it for Pesach, ideally. But really, it actually really doesn't matter, when it particularly comes to a dishwasher, because it's already been koshered beyond your control. What's that?
That's only Pesach. If it's easy for me, then for sure you have to get through it.
So the same thing is technically true, although you should wait. What holds true by Pesach, which is actually a little more controversial, is certainly true by a fleishik or a milchik dishwasher. In other words, what Tosus says here about chametz, everybody should agree when it comes to something that's fleishiks or milchiks, that Tosus would say you can kasher milchik kelim or fleishik kelim to make them parv within, even though they've been used in 24 hours, because the principle of not bar not is going to apply there, because milk or meat is heter.
If I use the dishwasher for meat within 24 hours, and now I can put in, like, things that have dairy on them?
No. There are two separate questions here. Are you going to switch a dishwasher back and forth between milk and meat, and do you need to actually kosher it? It's not a simple question. But if I were to say to you that you need to kosher it, so then I would tell you you should wait 24 hours before doing so. But in reality, you don't really need to wait 24 hours because it already koshered itself. That's my point. But my primary point here is that milk and meat certainly have the same din as chametz before the fourth hour on Pesach, which is that they are heter, and therefore, if you kasher, you shouldn't need 60 times in the water to be mevatel the tam of the meat or the tam of the milk, or Tosha says the tam of the chametz before the fourth hour, because you can rely upon nat bar nat. Our minhag is to always wait 24 hours, and therefore, it doesn't matter what was used in the pot. After 24 hours, everything is no seitam of gum, and therefore, you have not bar not, you have a teira, it's not going to be an issue at all. Yes?
Does it make a difference that chametz is a
mashahu? No, it doesn't matter, but chametz before Pesach has not been mashahu. Right? Chametz before Pesach is batel b'shishim. Even for this, by the way, is why you can't kasher kelim on Pesach, because for Svardim, you can't kasher kelim that are bnei yoman on Pesach, because kashering a ben yomo kli relies upon bittel. And on Pesach, so if you have a pot that was somehow used with chametz, and 24 hours haven't passed, let's say it's a non-Jew's pot, and now you want to use it, and he gives it to you on the first day of Chol Moed Pesach, so you can't kasher that, even a Sephardi can't kasher that, because the kashering would, even if he had shishim in the water, it wouldn't work, because chametz is b'mashahu. So on Pesach, so no way you could do Hagala. You can, by the way, I think I mentioned this, you can do Libun on Pesach, even for Ashkenazim, because Libun doesn't rely upon Bittul. Libun doesn't extract the absorptions, Libun destroys them where they are. But Hagala you can't do on Pesach for Svardim if the Kli is a Ben Yomo. And Ashkenazim are stringent on Pesach, not only for a Mashahu of Chametz, not even the smallest infinitesimal amount, even though Saint Tam Lefgam, the Ramah quotes two opinions, but I think our practice is to be stringent. So even a no Saint Tam Lefgam of a Mashahu, like the tiniest amount of chametz, less than 1/60, Ashkenazim Amachmir on Pesach, and therefore Ashkenazim cannot do Hagalas Kelim on chametz Kelim Pesach. You can do, if you have a kosher Pesach meat kli or a milk kli, whatever that, or something that accidentally got meat in it, that you could kasher, but you cannot kasher from chametz on Pesach for Ashkenazim. You could kasher, as long as it's kasher lePesach chaser shmaltz, you could kasher that on Pesach. Correct. You just can't kasher from chametz on Pesach, because hagolah normally within 24 hours of kli's usage relies upon bittul, and on chametz bePesach, which is also even after 24 hours, the same problem. It still relies upon bittul, and there is no bittul.
And what about libun during the year? Does it have to be Eina Ben Yoma?
I don't think, certainly if you talk about Libun Chamur, right, you don't need Eina Ben Yoma.
Okay.
because Liban will work on anything, even if it's a Ben Yoma. But it's only a requirement for Haggadah, because Haggadah will not work on certain circumstances. Trey food, Chametz on Pesach, it won't work within 24 hours. Therefore, the Ramah quotes a Midah not to kasher kelim within 24 hours of their last usage with what, you know, whatever you're presumably kashering them for. Okay. So that's what Tosus says here. And then he gives, all right, so he says, Dahave, not barnat shel heter, hechametz bika'ara, umimenu lamayim, umenamayim choser v'nivala bika'ara. Tosus says there are three stages of the transfer of the chametz, from the chametz into the pot when you originally cook it in it, from the pot into the water you're kashering, from the water you're kashering with back into the pot. That's not barnat, barnat, and vadayin hakol heter, says Tosus. It's still all mutter, right? Before the fourth hour, even if this pot were still chametz stick, I could use it, and therefore it's not even chametz stick. Okay, and then Tosus, you could skip down to the next paragraph. Tosus has one last point here. Tosus says, "Mashinagu lasos loses kli hamugol b'mayim tzon miyad achar hagala ein leda lamanagu kain." The practice is, and this should be done lechatchila. It doesn't prevent hagala from working. Is that after you do hagala, you're supposed to put the pour cold water over the kli that you did hagala on? And Tosus says, "No idea why. What's going on? Why is that required?" He says, "The ain lomar mishum ditznam beperek dam chatas v'chachamim omer mrika b'chamen u'shtifa betzonein." The Gemara in Zvachim talking about kashering kalim in the Beis Hamikdash that were cooked, that had a karbanos, that had sacrifices cooked in them. So the Torah says umorak v'shutaf b'mayim. That's the Torah's expression. Morak means to be purified, and shutaf means to be rinsed. So the Gemara says that mrika is with hot water and shtifa is with cold water. So Tosa says that's not a basis for our kashering. He says the hainu bekotchim avol betruma kamer hasim delesa. The Gemara says explicitly in Zvachim that vessels that were cooked even with truma, which has sanctity, but it's not a karban, it doesn't have that sanctity, doesn't require the shtifa. It only requires kashering, hagala, the marika, to get the absorptions out. So the requirement of putting cold water over kelim, that you can't learn it from kachim, that would only apply to karbanos. It doesn't apply to truma, and certainly doesn't apply to regular chulin food, which has no sanctity. And then Tosus gives a possibility. Some want to suggest that when you kosher your kalim that a karbanos cooked in them, you have to pour water over it twice. Maybe we have to. Maybe we only have to. And therefore, kachim karbanos require two pourings of water, but everything else truma doesn't require two, but it would require one, and maybe we would require one as well. Okay. Either way, the minhag is cited in Shulchan Aruch, so the proper thing to do after you kasher kelim is to put them in or pour cold water over them. It doesn't prevent the kashering from actually working. I think one of the Rishonim actually has a suggestion, which wouldn't apply anyway the way we kasher kelim, that we're afraid that the hot water that's still on the kelim has some of the absorptions in it, and if you leave it on sitting on the clay, it'll get reabsorbed. So you want the cold water to wash it off. It doesn't really work, if you think about it, because how quickly does stuff get absorbed? And the answer is instantaneously. So if you're worried about the hot water that's sitting on the outside of your vessel, that you have to pour the cold water on it, you're not going to have enough time to pour the cold water anyway. So, but okay, it certainly doesn't prevent the kashering from working, but nonetheless, the minhag is to pour cold water over the kelim after you hagal. It's also a good thing to do if you're koshering silver or silverware, because it gets pretty hot, so it will cool down so people won't burn their hands if they grab it. Okay. So now we come back to the Gemara. And now the Gemara is going to really deal with a very, very, very important question, which has significant ramifications in halacha. I would make the following statements. If you have, which is the outcome of the whole Gemara, so we may not get back to that today, but we talk about having to do libun, using fire versus doing hagala, and the rule that we've described is that something that is cooked without a liquid medium, it is roasted dry, it requires libun. Something which is cooked with a liquid, and that's the medium through which the absorptions travel, that requires only hagala. Kibolo, the way it absorbs, kach polto, is the way it will spit out, it will emit what it absorbed. Now, I will make the following assertion. If I have a vessel that was cooked with kosher meat, I have a spit that was used on the grill, for example, and I can clean it properly, okay? And it was used with meat roasting, or something similar with milk. One, a better example would actually be probably a frying pan, okay? Because that's where it gets very complicated. because you can't. There are a lot of frying pans. If they have a Teflon coating, you can't do Liban on. If I have a frying pan that was fleishik, or a frying pan that was milchik, and I can clean it properly, so there are no cracks that I can't get into. But I can clean it, and I can clean it properly. You never have to do Liban on that to make it parf. Hagala is always sufficient. Now, what is the rule? The rule is that whenever you have what is called hetere bala, whenever a vessel absorbs something that is heter, when it absorbs it, it does never require, if you can clean it properly, it never requires libun. Hagala is always sufficient. Now, if you were to think about that for a moment, why is that so significant? Well, you might have come up with a leniency that many Rishonim hold of, but we don't paskin like, which is, if you're kashering kelim before Pesach, do you ever require libun? If you were to argue that chametz is heter, then your pots that absorb chametz, hagala should always be sufficient. Your frying pan, it should always be sufficient. If your oven, if you can do the equivalent of hagala on your oven, it should always be sufficient. Why? Because the rule is, when it ever absorbs something that's heter, you never require libun. Hagala is always considered sufficient. Why is that true? We'll explore that a little bit in the Gemara in a moment. So let me hold off on that. But I think that based upon what we described about nap or not, it'll give you room to start thinking about the question. But there's a big machlokas harishonim. You see, if that were true, what I just described, the Shulchan Aruch and Hilchos Pesach, talking about Kasher and Kalim, shouldn't even mention the word Liban. It shouldn't exist in the vocabulary. But the Mechaber does talk about the requirement of Liban. Why? Because there's a major machlokas harishonim as to the status of Chametz, which is absorbed before Pesach. Do we say that Chametz before Pesach, before the fourth hour, is considered hetera bala? It absorbed heter? Or do we say that it's considered isura bala? That even though you're allowed to consume chametz right now, it already has the status of chametz. And therefore, you don't have the leniencies of saying hetere bala, and you never need to do libun. Doing hagala would always be sufficient. Happens to be, it's a big machlokas harishonim. Tosos on the next amun is going to assume chametz before Pesach is hetere bala. There are many rishonim who do assume that way, and there are many rishonim who don't, and the Shulchan Aruch is stringent. So that leniency doesn't actually apply by chametz, but it does exist by basar or chalav. Not basar b'chalav, but basar, either meat or milk. That leniency of hetere bala does in fact exist. So where does that come from, and why does it exist? So let's take a look at the Gemara. The Gemara on the end of the fourth line on Daf Ayin Vav Amud Aleph says the following: Rami le Rav Amram le Rav Sheshes. Rav Amram presented a contradiction of two Mishnayos to Rav Sheshes and asked him to resolve the contradiction. Tinan, it says in our Mishnah right here on the previous Amud, the previous page. Hashputin va'askala milabnon ba'or. If you have a spit or a grate, so it's something that's used directly on the fire with no liquid medium, you have to do libun in fire in order to kasher it. And it was talking about treif, right? Our Mishnah is talking about vessels, kitchen food vessels that were purchased from non-Jews, and therefore they are treif. We're not talking about their milchiks, their fleishiks, their chametzdik, they're glot treif. The Mishnah says that on these vessels you have to do libun. But v'hotnan, the Mishnah in Zvachim says, gabe kodshim, with respect to things that were used to roast karbanos, roast meat of sacrifices, hashpud v'haskala magilan b'chamin. You simply have to kasher them in hot water. So, why? Does a spit and a grate require libun, or does it require hagala? Which one is it? So, amar lei, Rav Sheshes responded, Amram Bari, Amram my son. Ma inyan, he's a student. Ma inyan kachim etzel gilei ovdei kochavim. How can you compare the question of treif food to the question of kachim, of karbanos that were absorbed? Hacha hetera bala, hasam isura bala. And that comparable. Here, by the karbanos, when you cook the karban on a spit, on a grate, it's absorbing that which is permissible to consume now. The guy is cooking tarfus on it. How can you compare the two? So immediately, immediately, Amar, it should be Rabbah, so what? Ki kapolet, isura kapolet. Doesn't matter, I don't care. The fact that right now, it's the carbon's kosher, wait 24 hours, well, not even 24 hours, wait till the next morning, the end of the next day, whichever carbon it is, and the carbon will be nosar, and the absorptions of that carbon inside the pot will also be nosar. It will be carbon that was left past its time. Someone who eats nosar is chayv karis. If they do it on purpose, they have to bring another carbon if they eat a pishoke. So who cares that when it absorbed the carbon, it was kosher. After the time limit has passed of eating the carbon, it's now treif. When you cook the next meat in it, whatever you cook in it, it should make that treif. So what difference does it make how it started out? Now, I know it seems like I've ruined everything now because what I told you is wrong. The Gemara is going to come back to this at the end. But right now, because Rabbah didn't understand, he has a different approach. Ela ama Rabbah, my hagala, nami, shtifa umarika. So Rabbah says that the hagala that the Gemara is talking about, the Mishnah in Zvachim, is not talking about hot water. It's talking about marika and shtifa bitzonin. In other words, that Gemara is not talking about how you kasher the kli, getting the treif stuff out. That, of course, you would need to do libun. You need to do libun here, you need to do libun there. But what the Mishnah in Zvachim is telling you is that by a carbon, there's an additional requirement, which is you have to rinse it off with cold water afterwards. Not because it gets absorptions out, not because it cleans it, but because the Torah said so. The Torah said so, morak v'shutap amayim. So you could still have to cleanse it in fire, or the spit or the grate, but nonetheless, when you're done, so the Mishnah there is talking about a different aspect. It's not talking about the kashri aspect. It's talking about, I'll call it the kedusha aspect. The way we treat those vessels, you rinse them off with cold water afterwards. So the Gemara, Amalei Abaye says to his Rebbe Rabbah, mi dami, that's crazy. Mariko shtifa betzonein hagala b'chanin. What do you mean? The Mishnah in Zvachim said, hashpud v'askala mag'ilan. Magilan doesn't mean cold water. Hagala, shtifa marika might be cold water. Hagala always means hot water. In fact, the term hagala is used, it means to extract, to cause to spit out. So that's not what the cold water does. Hagala is bechamin. That can't be the resolution. Ela amar Abaye. Abaye says, yagir alav reo. He quotes a pasuk in Iyov. This is not the context of it, but its friend will shed light, will tell about it. And what does that mean? Tanaha halibun. Our Mishnah mentions libun. V'hu adin hagala. And you also have to do hagala. And tanaha sam hagala. That Mishnah mentions hagala. V'hu adin libun. So Abaye comes up with an incredible stringency. Abaye, it sounds like whenever you have to do libun on a vessel, you also have to do hagala. You have to do both. If it's not used directly on the fire, then hagala is sufficient. But if it's used directly on the fire, you have to do libun and you have to do hagala. You have to do both. Our Mishnah mentions Libun. Yeah, it didn't bother to mention Hagala. The Mishnah in Zvachim mentioned Hagala. Oh, I forgot to mention Libun. But you have to put the two together. So Amar Le Rabbah. Rabbah doesn't like that. He doesn't like that answer. Rabbah says, not Rabbah. Rabbah was, it was Rav Sheshes, then Rabbah, then Abaye, now Rabbah. Amar Le Rabbah. Ihachi, lisnunu l'chulu b'chada v'lesne chada b'idach acharisi v'lema yag l'rav reo. Rabbah makes the following claim. If you want to say that one Mishnah didn't spell everything out, in order for that to work literarily, one Mishnah has to spell out everything, and the other Mishnah can spell out one of the things, and we'll just put in etc. In other words, our Mishnah could have said that you have to do Libun, you have to do Hagala, and the Mishnah in Zvachim could have said you do Hagala, and it's understood, etc. You have to do Libun also. But if you only have one Mishnah mentions one thing, and another Mishnah something else, you can't employ this principle of Yagid Lav Reo, that the Mishnah here gave you one detail, and that Mishnah gave you a different detail, and you're supposed to put them together. Rava says that doesn't work. So what does Rava say? Ela Amar Rava, Kodshim Hainu Taimaihu Kidrav Nachman. Amar Rava Bar Havua. De Amar Kol Yom V'Yom Nase Gil Lachavera. So Rava suggests something very interesting here. It's so interesting, it's an answer that's too clever and too good. Rava says the following. You know why Hagala is sufficient? Because today, what did I do? I cooked in this pot, let's say, a carbon chatas. And a chatas expiration is going to be tomorrow morning, when at the crack of dawn. And rabbinically, it will be at midnight, actually. Okay, but at some point, midnight, next morning, the chatas becomes a problem, which means the absorptions become a problem. But what did I do after I cooked the carbon chatas? I cooked another carbon in there. And when I cooked the second carbon, you know what the second carbon does? It extracts the absorptions from the first carbon. And so that's not, it's no longer in the pot. It's not a problem. Now, of course, the problem is that eventually you're going to hit the wall, though, because the day, at some point, you can cook the next carbon. I call it just turtles all the way down. You're going to cook the next carbon and the next carbon. At some point, you hit the expiration, and everything expires, and you still have a problem. So the Gemara says, one second, the Gemara says, Tenach shlamim. You know, it works for shlamim. The chevan de l'shnei yamim is akle. A carbon shlamim, if I shech the shlamim now, I go to the Beis HaMikdash, we had a Beis HaMikdash, I shech the shlamim now, I'm allowed to eat it for 2 days and one night. What that means is, the rest of the day on which I slaughtered it, the entire night and the entire next day. The carbon shlamim is really the only carbon that I have that kind of time period. Virtually every other carbon, we'll say that for the moment, its expiration time is going to be by next morning. But a shlamim, I could cook in it today, today's shlamim, and tomorrow I could still be eating the shlamim.
What kind of animal
is shlamim? Cow, goat, or sheep. It could come from any of them. Tomorrow, I could all day be cooking stuff in it, and it will get out yesterday's shlamim when I'm still allowed to consume yesterday's shlamim. So the Gemara says, Hatenach, that if you cook in it shlamim, the chevan de lishnei yamim misakle, since it may be eaten for 2 days, mikame de nehave nosar, kohave gil. Before the shlamim becomes nosar, at the end, sunset tomorrow, sometime tomorrow, during the day, I cook the next carbon. That works. So for shlamim, I can cook today's shlamim today, tomorrow I cook tomorrow's shlamim, I could keep going, not a problem. Now, you realize that I've glossed over something very important, which the Gemara will ask in a second. Okay, but the Gemara says, but chatas, ela chatas, kevan de liyom v'layla misakla. Chatas can only be eaten until the next morning. Ki mevashel bo ha'idona chatas, when I cook in it now, chatas, have a nosar, when the night ends, ki hadam mevashel le lemachar, when I cook in that pot tomorrow. O shlamim o chatas, it doesn't matter what I cook. Kapolit nosar de chatas ta'idona, it will extract today's chatas, which is now nosar, bechatas ushlamim delamachar, and you have a problem. So how's it going to work? So the Gemara says the following: Amrei lo tzricha. You know how you work it for Rava? The rule is the chimivashel bechatas haidana hadar mevashel bahidana shlamim. Whenever I cook chatas in a pot, I always make sure that I cook shlamim today's shlamim after it, and therefore the chimivashel. So you get around the problem that the way the time you're always cooking to get stuff out before the time expires. Wonderful idea. It's such a good idea. All right, it's such a great idea. Now, by the way, what the Gemara does imply here, and the Shulchan Aruch talks about this, and I think Me'ikar Adin we hold it works. I know this would be highly wasteful, but let's say I want to kasher my pots with wine. Can I use wine instead of boil the wine? Boil the wine and kasher it? Though it sounds from this Gemara, not to my wine specifically, is that you can. You don't need clean water to kasher. Cooking anything with liquid, filling it to the brim in a pot, will have the effect of extracting that which was in it before. So the Gemara says, if this is the system that Rav is describing, that they consistently would keep, you would never need to kasher at all. In other words, the next thing you cook in it would always be kashering. So Rav's answer is too clever by a half, because the Mishnah says in Zvachim, you do have to do Hagala, right? You do need to put boiling water in it to kasher it. So if Rav were correct that they were so careful, and you can imagine, even though Kohanim are careful, this is a recipe for disaster. So the Gemara says, if Rav is right, you shouldn't even require Hagala. Not only should you not require Lipun, you shouldn't require Hagala. So now the Gemara says the following. Kasha. Don't have an answer. Rav Papa Amar no. Hai karid, hai lo karid. Rav Papa gives a very interesting answer, which again goes back to my theory that really, a lot of Blias Kalim is the stuff it's just on the surface or barely beneath the surface. It's kind of a film. Rav Papa says the following. The Goyim don't cook in their Kalim constantly. Pots in the Beis HaMikdash were being used constantly because there were lots and lots of karbanos to cook. So he says that the stuff, the tarfus that the Goy baked onto his shpud or askala, his spit or grate, that's already going to be hardened by now. That's really hard to get off. It's caked on. Whereas the chatas the carbonos that were being cooked on the spit and the ask and the grate, it's constantly stuff's being cooked. It never has the chance to kind of just totally dry out and be caked on a way that Libun wouldn't work on it. That's what Rav Papa suggests. Rav Ashi finally comes along and he gives a totally different answer. Rav Ashi says, La'olam ki da'amaran me'ikara. The what Rav Shesha said, that the difference between treif vessels and karbanos vessels is that hacha hatera bala and hacha isura bala. Ah, but Rabbah had a great question. Udeka kashalach, that which you asked, that the be'idona dekapolit, isura kapolit, yeah, you tell me, yeah, but tomorrow when it emits it, it's going to be isur. Be'idona dekapolit lo isa le isura be'ene. So he says something interesting. Literally, it means one thing. I think it means something. You have to explain. He says, at the time that the pot tomorrow will emit the nosar is no longer be'en. It's not extant in a physical recognizable form. So the question is, okay, but so what? You can taste it. So it seems that what Rav Ashi means is that in order for nosar, you start out with with meat that is kachim, that is permissible to consume. And then, at some point, Nosar comes and it sinks its fingers into that meat. When daybreak comes, it sinks its teeth into that meat and makes it Nosar. The Gemara is saying something can only be Nosar. Nosar can only set in on something that's extant, something that's tangible, something that's real. Once something has been reduced to Tom and it's not yet Nosar, Nosar cannot come along and set in on it. It sets in on it, but in a very, 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 very weak form. And therefore, as long as you do Hagala on it, Hagala is sufficient to get out enough that it is no longer considered Nosar. It's a very, it's a slightly, not a very arithmetical concept, but the idea is that once, nobody says, Rav Ashi doesn't say you don't have to kasher the Kalim, but he says that when you want to say that Nosar is flavoring your food, at that point, Nosar is not be'en, and therefore Hagala is considered sufficient. And he doesn't fully flesh out, but why do you need Hagala, or why is Hagala sufficient? But the answer is, on a weakened tam, Hagala is sufficient. If you want to think about something, not quite, it's not the same thing, it's in a different direction of an analog, we assume that when something requires libun, Hagala will not get out everything. It will get out some, but not out everything, and then the next time you use it, it's a problem. There is a discussion in the Bishonim, I think we're stringent, but there is a discussion that is raised. Let's say I have something that requires libun. I have a spit or a grate that requires libun, but I do hagala on it. Can I use it with liquids, with hot liquids? In other words, would we say that whatever could ever come out with hot liquids, I got out through hagala? Whatever I didn't, well, if I used it again directly on the flame, that would be a problem, but it's not a problem for when I'm using it with liquids. So there certainly is an idea that Hagala gets out a lot, if not most of the absorptions, but when you deal with something like Libun, it doesn't get out everything. So apparently, when you're dealing with something which is Hetere Bala, when it absorbs it, it's Heter, then it is sufficient to get out most of it, because since when you want the status of prohibition to set in on it, it's no longer extant, it's no longer Be'en, so somehow Nosar doesn't have the capacity to prohibit in that degree. It would have been nice if Rav Ashi spelled that a little bit more, but that would appear to be what he's driving at. But what emerges from that is that whenever you're dealing with Hetera Bala, which would be true for Chametz according to some Rishonim, but we don't Paskin that way, if you're dealing with milk or you're dealing with meat, so then you should never require, unless you can't clean it properly, you should never require Libun. So if you, the big issue this comes up with is frying pans that have a Teflon coating, because you can't do Libun on them, you'll destroy the pan if you take a blowtorch to them. So the question is, do they require kashering? I once got this shaila from a student about, I think it was a frying pan. I think it was a relative, someone who had passed away who kept kosher, but they didn't know what the frying pan was. Was it milchiks or fleishiks? So the first question is, why does a frying pan require libun? A frying pan, you cook in it with a liquid. So in theory, a frying pan shouldn't require libun, but the Shulchan Aruch quotes a chumrah about doing libun because sometimes the oil or the liquid in dries up completely and it ends up being the equivalent of dry roasting, and therefore a frying pan should really have libun done to it. But if you're dealing with something, so if it's a tray frying pan and it's Teflon coated, you're out of luck because you can't do libun and you need to do libun. But if you're talking about, and it might be true for chametz before Pesach also, it might be a problem because we hold that chametz is considered Isur Abela. But if you had a frying pan that was either milchix or fleshix, but let's say you didn't know, so in that case, Hagala would be sufficient to kasher it, to restore it to being parv, because milk or meat is considered heterabala, and when it comes to heterabala, you do not require libun. The only time we would require libun on something that was just milchix or just fleshix is if the kli had cracks in or things where you couldn't clean them out properly, so then we say you have to do libun, at least on the cracks, and therefore it would, you know, might defeat the purpose. But if it were just milchix or just fleshix, so then hagala is sufficient under all circumstances, even in something that was used directly on the fire.
And how do you do hagala on a frying pan with a pot? You just boil the water over. And what about the handle on the...
So firstly, you can do hagala in sections. So if you have a big enough pot that you can put it into, half of anything you put in half, and put in the other half. The handle, l'chatchil, I think the Rama says you're supposed to kasher, but I think you would also kasher the handle. He says, b'dievet, it's not going to make the stuff you a problem with the food you cook in it. And I think he says that you can kasher the handle with irimi kli rishon by pouring the boiling water onto it, because that's the only way the handle absorbs also. I think so. It's addressed explicitly in Shulchan Aruch. Well, that will, except for the handles part.
Yeah, and
Right. So the next step we come to is, okay, so now let's say it won't fit into anything else. Let's leave aside the handles question, because those can be kosher with irmi kli rishon, but let's say you have a pot that won't fit into anything else, and you can't even fit half of it into anything else. So the Gemara now tells the following. Firstly, v'ad kama, four lines from the bottom, v'ad kama malabnon, how hot does the libun have to be? Amar avani achetasher klipasan. Until you remove the out, hot enough to peel away the hour later, whatever exactly that means. Usually, I think when we talk about libun with a blowtorch, they talk about till it's somehow glowing red or a certain temperature that would glow red. There is another kind of libun that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. I'm not going to go into any of the details. In certain situations where Meikar hadin, hagala should suffice, but if for whatever reason you can't do it, or there are certain chumras, we allow something that's called libun kal. It's not as hot as regular libun. I think libun kal is defined as if you were to put paper to it, it would ignite. Kash, a straw. Straw would ignite. But this, the Gemara is describing here, is libun chumra. This is full-fledged libun, a blowtorch or a self-cleaning oven are generally considered acceptable forms, sufficient levels of heat. Okay. And then the Ketzad Magilan. How do you do Hagala? So Amar Rav Huna, Yora Ketana Besoch Yora Gedola. Small pot, you put into a bigger pot. But Yora Gedola Mai, that's the problem. So I'm going to read just two lines in the Gemara to give the way they did it, and then next week we'll talk a little more about this and other ways of dealing with the same issue. The concern that they have is primarily the top of the pot, where stuff can boil over, can splatter over. So the Gemara tells the following: Tashma, the Ahududa, the Havabei Rab Ukva, or Rakavia. There was this big pot in the house of this particular Amora. Ahadarle Gadnapa Dalisha Apuma. He took dough. He made a thick dough, and he put it around the rim, leaving the top exposed. And then Umal Yuhamaya Va'artecha. He filled it with water. And now he could fill the water higher because it had an additional rim, and it was now able to boil it touching the top of the pot. Now, this is, of course, very nice, generally speaking, but this doesn't really work for Pesach. Because if you take a dough around the outside, well, great, you kasher the chametz in the thing, and now you made the pot's chametz on different grounds. So there, the Shulchan Aruch talks about clay. Clay is what's suggested using there. There is another way of doing this. And now the Gemara just explains this line. We'll finish with this. Amar Rava man chakim lemavet keamilsa in lav Rava Kavya. The Gavar Rabahu. He's really smart. The Kasavar kibolo kach polto. Mabolo benitzotzos. Ach polto benitzotzos. So he says that you don't have to immerse the entire pot inside another pot, you only have to get the parts that came in contact with the food. And therefore, the top of the rim really just has stuff that splatters all over it, or maybe occasionally boils over, so that's all you have to do as well. You just have to get the rim, and then you are fine. So that was Mar Ukva's, that's who it is, it's not clear who the name is, Rav Ukva, Rav Akavia, Mar Ukva. That was how he kashered the pots, and that is one way of kashering pots. We'll come back to this next week, and we'll talk about other ways of dealing with it if you don't have, you know, dough or clay handy to wrap around the rim of your pot. So there are other ways of actually doing it.